Now, we're going to do something a bit different, but this is going to be absolutely fascinating, I promise you. So Dr. Douglas Terrier is the chief technologist with NASA, and you're in Ireland, Douglas, for the Dublin Tech Summit, and you're very welcome. So you were speaking at the summit about something called the Moon to Mars program, and I want to get to that in a minute because it will blow people's minds, I think. But first, I suppose we should talk about, we saw incredible photos during the week of a black hole. It got huge attention internationally. And so it's for those of us who are not space buffs, vague idea of what a black hole is and everything. How important was this that we got a photograph of a black hole?
Yeah, so good morning. It's a pleasure to be here and wonderful to be with you. This has been an exciting week. We've just had a whole series of events this week, including the discovery of the black hole image that was released. By the way, this is an undertaking that was primarily led by European space agencies and researchers around Europe, but around the world. So, you know, going back to a century ago where Albert Einstein, with his theory of relativity, predicted...
Yeah, we're not getting into the theory of relativity, Douglas. Right. We'll take it as read, okay?
They predicted this would exist, but the remarkable thing is that today we have the ability to actually see what had been just a postulated existence.
So was it a theoretical concept up to when we actually saw this picture?
Yeah,
have we had any proof before?
We've had indirect images, or evidence, like we could see starlight bent around black hole, but this is the first time we've actually imaged the black hole region itself, and it was just a fantastic, as I said, international collaboration. Hundreds of researchers, telescopes across four continents joined together to integrate and work together and process that image to produce, what is, for the first time, we can conclusively see an image showing that our theories are exactly correct.
Okay, well, and I suppose the age of social media does change all these things as well, in that the whole world really, and I think particularly Katie Boumain, the 29-year-old, I think her algorithm was critical in all this. And that photograph that went around the world of her seeing the picture downloading on her screen, it's great publicity for space.
It is, and it kind of captures that most important part of space, which is its ability to ignite the imagination of young people and inspire young people the world over. So those of my generation were inspired by the Apollo landings, and mm-hmm. that's kind of propelled my career. And it's just wonderful to see this continue, cascade of discoveries that are now propelling our young people around the world.
Now, Moon to Mars. Why don't you explain? The plan here is... we're going to get humans back on the moon by 2024. They're then going to live there and use this as a base to go to Mars?
Yeah.
Am I over-exaggerating there? That is going to happen in the next 5 years.
This is what's incredible about what we're doing now. So, you know, a lot of people ask, well, we've been to the moon. And like many of our discoveries, there's one thing to do a sortie for a couple hours and return, which is what we did earlier. Now we're returning to live and work on the moon. So what we've been doing at NASA and with our international partners in space is to really extend humans' presence out into from the Earth. Now we're living and working in low Earth orbit on the International Space Station with 15 countries, now for 18 years living and working in space. We're taking that same model and moving it out now to the region of the moon, where we'll have settlements on the moon, have the ability to live and work, and more importantly, not just to kind of pack your supplies and go for a short duration, but to actually live off the environment. And the goal is, there are really two goals there. One, to be able to produce the water and the oxygen and the fuel from the in-situ resources there on the moon for the folks working on the moon. But maybe in the long run, more importantly, to provide that as sort of a port for reprovisioning missions that would go further out into space onto Mars and beyond.
Okay, can I ask you some stupid questions?
No stupid questions.
So,
go ahead.
When they go to the moon, are they going to live in the whatever vessel they go to the moon in, or is there some element of, like, I mean, to put it in layman's terms, are they going to build a house on the moon, or...
So both. This will be done in stages, like you would any settlement. Initially, our plans call for building something called a gateway, which is an outpost, sort of a equivalent of the International Space Station orbiting the moon, and then we'll be able to go down to the surface, in sorties and periodically, but eventually to actually put habitats on the surface of the moon and live and work there.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And you mentioned about living off the resources of the moon, and again, I'll plead ignorance here. What do we know about what there is to sustain human life on the moon? Yeah. Like, presumably, can you grow plants in some kind of version of a greenhouse or something that you'd bring?
Presumably,
there?
You could do that in the long run. So, one of the most essential things we need for any human habitation is water, right? Uh-huh. So, we just a few decades ago we would be speculating again, unlike the black hole. It's just remarkable how rapidly our knowledge is advancing. So we would speculate there might be water. We now have conclusive proof that there's, billions of gallons of water particularly in the South Pole regions, North Pole, in shadowed craters that we can then extract.
Okay, and it's water as we understand
it's
it,
ice
H2O.
H2O, but at a very, very cold temperature, just, 40 degrees or so above absolute zero. So it's been preserved there because that region in the shadow of the craters never received sunlight, so it hasn't sublimated into space. So we are able to take that water, and we're able to obviously use for drinking water, which is obviously crucial to maintaining human life. But equally importantly, we're able to split that water using, clean sources of power, be able to split that water into oxygen and hydrogen, which then provides us basically the elements of rocket fuel that we can use for power there as well as resupplying future missions.
And using clean energy, what's the energy source going to be?
So the cool thing is that on the South Pole of the moon, because the moon, unlike our Earth that's tilted at 22 degrees or so on its axis, the moon is straight up and down, the axis of the moon. So at the poles, you can receive sunlight year round. So solar energy basically is one source of energy that would be very attractive to use on the moon, particularly in the polar regions.
Okay. Now, it's been, you mentioned the Apollo landing that inspired your generation and still probably the iconic thing there. And you hear this thing quoted a lot, so that's 50 years ago, that you hear quoted a lot that the vessels that went up then had the computing power that we now have in an iPhone. Is that true?
That is not only true, that's actually understating. It's, they're really more comparable to something like a Commodore 64. The iPhone is far more powerful than the computers on the Apollo's missions were.
So they were going up there with like Stone Age kind of technology, really.
Yeah, but what's really cool is that space is such a challenging environment, right? It's so expensive to get anything mass into space that they were forced to drive the technology to the limit at that time. So they drove the miniaturization of electronics, leading to all these, all the laptops and the iPhones and everything really were incentivized by that push to push that technology as fast forward as possible. So at the time, they were the most advanced computers, and we've seen the exponential growth of that since.
Yeah, so presumably what we could do now is...
Exactly.
Light years.
And that's a key message, right, is that what we do in space, what we're going to do today, is again going to drive another wave of development of advanced technologies that we'll see sort of infuse back into our lives in all kinds of ways.
And did we, again, I'll put this in layman's terms, did we lose interest in the moon for a while then? Because you didn't hear much about the moon or anyone landing there. We heard about Israel crashing into it during the week. But did it go off the agenda in some way or...
No, so what we've done is, if you think of exploration, as I said, our mission is to really, in a stepwise, methodical fashion, push humans further out, right? So we do that in a couple of different ways. One of them is our robotic precursors that you can think of, the scouts, and they've gone, first they went to the moon before the humans did, then they are on to Mars, and we visited every object in our solar system so far. Behind that, we have these initial sortie missions of the humans, like the Apollo.
Okay.
And then we follow with the long-term development and settlement. And then finally, we hopefully have commercial enterprise following behind us. So what we've done is, even though we did that first sortie mission in the 60s, in the meantime, we've been concentrating on what we call low Earth orbit, where the International Space Station is, where we've developed that as not just a sortie, but a permanent settlement. So we've been living and working there for 18 years now with the international community of 15 countries building and working on the International Space Station, doing thousands of experiments every year that, from medicine to materials to pharmaceuticals, anything you think of, combustion, that are giving us the knowledge of how to live and work in space over a long duration, giving us technologies that come back to Earth, but also preparing for those long-duration stays on the moon.
Okay.
And we'll use the moon in the same way to prepare to learn how to live on Mars eventually.
Okay, this is all sounds like science fiction to people in a sense, right? So when do you see the moon being colonized in any kind of real fashion, people living up there in any kind of regular way?
So, you know, as you know, the president has challenged us to return humans to the moon by 2024, which is just 5 short years away. So we're in quite a tempo and quite an excited mode right now. And it'll be like any settlement. Initially, there'll just be a few astronauts, dedicated people working. We expect to see that gradually expand to include our international partners participating, living and working. But what we hope is that over the next decades, we'll see commercial reasons to have folks entering space and entering the lunar region and hopefully have colonies set up. And on just as we're seeing in low Earth orbit, for example, we're seeing that move today from being purely a government concern to, you know, people like Sir Richard Branson and SpaceX and, Jeff Bezos, private sector companies entering that region. We see the same thing follow the government enterprise on the moon as well.
And now, so in terms of the private sector being involved, you're here in Ireland. Is it to kind of talk to tech companies here and see how they can get involved in what you're doing?
Yeah, so my job, in addition to trying to guide the investments of NASA's technology internally, is also to understand how we can partner with brilliant innovators all over the world. So,
and does Ireland have any input at the moment into what NASA's doing?
Yeah,
do you see potential?
You know, Ireland is actually quite involved already in many of our efforts. So supporting primarily through ESA, supporting what we're doing on the James Webb Telescope, the next big follow-on to the Hubble. Ireland's very involved in that. We met with Irish industry in an industry roundtable organized by Enterprise Ireland yesterday, where we saw a dozen companies representing the finest, most innovative, world-class technologies in everything from photonics to space electronics, marine technologies, a whole range of things that are of great interest to us at NASA, and many of which, by the way, are already being applied not just in NASA and ESA-led programs, government programs, but in fact, some of these companies are already on board with the commercial companies, with Boeing and SpaceX, providing them with great technology.
Okay. You've also been meeting with John Halligan, who's Minister of State for Training, Skills, Innovation, Research and Development. So is John Halligan interested in this space race? Did you get it? Is he a bit of a space buff?
Absolutely. Yeah? Kind of a bit of a space fanatic. And I think we kind of hit it off. We had a meeting with him on Wednesday morning. Just an absolutely fantastic meeting. It was great to see the energy that Minister Halligan and his team are putting into really focusing attention on developing Ireland's high technology sector, which, by the way, is impressive across the board, not just in the space arena. But the minister outlined for us the plans that they have over the long term to continue to advance Irish industry in the innovative space and high tech sectors. And you got a great supporter there, and we consider him a great partner.
Okay, he'd be glad to hear that. Now, speaking of the technology to get into space and everything, a story that people will have noticed recently was that the first all-female spacewalk had to be abandoned because they didn't have spacesuits to fit them. And I guess people thought that seemed a bit odd, that if they were planning this, why didn't they have the spacesuits to fit them? But then you look into it and spacesuits are kind of a bit more of an involved thing.
It's quite a bit more involved. And, this is one of the areas where we kind of use a very common layman's term, say a space suit. It sounds like it's a garment. It's not. It's actually better thought of as an individual tailored spacecraft, a one-person spacecraft. It has these suits for extravehicular activities, for EVAs, we call them, going outside. The astronauts actually entering the space on their own, completely separated from any other kind of life support or anything. So all the thermal control systems, the life support systems, the oxygen, everything has to be power on board that spacecraft, has to function perfectly. We have a very complex choreography that occurs of ensuring that we have spacesuits on the station. So typically we have, today we have about 4 of them on board, and they come in a range of sizes.
Okay, so what you're saying is that not everybody gets their own spacesuit.
Not everybody gets their own spacesuit.
They actually come in a modular fashion.
They come in modular fashion, and they have to be reconfigured to fit a particular crew member's dimensions. They're actually quite hard to physically move, and it's important that it's fit precisely.
And so, am I right in thinking, though, that the spacesuits being used now are the same ones that were being used 40 years ago? Is that...
The design has been pretty, pretty. You know, the initial design was what we used on the shuttle program, but they've been refurbished constantly, which is a part of the logistics. We have to actually bring them down in a very, like I said, complex choreography to bring them down to earth, to be refurbished, to be, you know, all the new designs and technology incorporated. And then we have a total of about 12 in very different modular sizes, as you mentioned. Four of which are on the station right now. I think there are two mediums, a large and an extra large. And they come in torsos and arms and different pieces that can be reconfigured. Okay. So in this particular thing, it was determined that to configure for Anne's specific dimensions, it would have taken more than 12 hours of crew time. And they were very pressed for time. And she herself, along with the team, made the decision that she'd rather see that time used for experiments. And so the decision was made to defer her EVA. But
have you been to space?
I have not been to space myself, no. I'm a pilot, and I would love that opportunity. And I think many of us will get that opportunity in the coming years.
And do you work quite closely with astronauts?
Yeah, we do. So that's one of the things that I think is maybe, I'm from the Johnson Space Center in Houston, which is where the astronauts train, and we have all our flight surgeons and support teams, mission control for the human space flight missions. And one of the things that is maybe not commonly realized is these folks work alongside the engineering teams, not only they don't just fly, they help to design the vehicle and are involved in all aspects of operating the program, you know, as expertise that they can bring to designing the vehicles.
And now I'm going to preface this with that a lot of my knowledge of this will come from the big and small screen, probably particularly most recently the first, which was the Sean Penn TV series. I don't know if you saw that about the kind of lives of astronauts around space travel. But it seems that, like, you'd want to be quite a particular kind of person, wouldn't you? Because it does seem like that you devote your whole life to this thing, incredible discipline and everything, for something that you might do once, if at all. At most, you'll do it, what, a couple of times, a few times?
Yeah, so some of our, you know, 3-4 times probably is the average that our astronauts will fly. But it is, in fact, a very, very specialized skill set that's required to do this.
But I'm thinking more about the kind of person you need to be as well. You need to be different, do you?
You do need to be a different type because, you know, you're talking in some cases, and the missions we're preparing for now, when you start talking long-term about going to Mars, you could be in space for 2 years at a time, away from everybody and everything you know. And you're confined in a very, very small space with three of your best friends for a long period. Yeah. So it's not
starting
just
out as your best friends.
Right,
anyway,
exactly. Yeah. It's not just the physiological requirements and, you know, technical skills, but psychologically.
Is it still quite dangerous, physically dangerous? The chance of death still there?
So, you know, space is easily the most challenging environment in which humans try to live and work. And it is always a serious, very, very serious undertaking. So that's the thing that's most present in everything we do, is that sense of, you know, ensuring safety, which is, with the technology that we have today, we are literally pushing the limits of science and technology in these exploration missions. So we're right on the edge at all times.
But you've got unknown unknowns there, obviously.
That's
all
true
the time
as well.
And then I'm thinking about the families they need to be very bought into this, don't they? I'm guessing that the husband or wife of an astronaut has to make a certain accommodation with themselves about things.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you brought that up, because it takes a certain type of individual to be an astronaut, but it certainly takes a certain kind of family support to be able to do that successfully. You know, these guys are and women are away, not just in doing their training during the day, and of course the flights, which, you know, it could be from weeks to months, in some cases a year, right? Like the Kelly, you know, Scott Kelly did recently, but their training regime requires them to go to Russia to train with our Russian cosmonaut teams for months at a time. So there's quite a lot of demands on both the individual and the families that support them.
Yeah, I'll bet. And speaking of the danger and everything, we saw there was an interesting story during the week there in terms of the health effects of going to space. So this guy, Scott Kelly, you mentioned there, who spent 340 days in the International Space Station, and they seem to have, I don't know how scientific this is, but they took his twin brother as well, and who stayed on Earth, and they looked at him. But there were stuff like he experienced genetic mutations, he experienced declines in cognitive test scores after it. I gather after 6 months, most things were largely righted, but there was still, there were genetic changes, weren't there? Do we know much about the effects on people's health?
Yeah, we do actually. So this is one of the areas that we have, you mentioned that we've been in this business for quite some time. And what we've been doing is learning how not just to have the mechanical vehicle systems perform better in space, but how to have humans perform and be healthy and productive in space. And a lot of our research efforts, a lot of efforts that I help to guide are really targeted at the human system and how we can develop countermeasures for the environment in space, where you have microgravity, you have radiation effects because you're outside of a lot of the protective layers of the Earth's atmosphere, and in some cases beyond the Van Allen belts. So there's a serious risk there that you wouldn't encounter on Earth. The cool thing about that is that we've been very successful, actually, particularly with the work that we've been doing for the last decades on the International Space Station, in understanding how to develop countermeasures for a lot of these effects. And the coolest part of that is a lot of the things that we're bringing to bear on understanding, you mentioned, bone loss and muscle atrophy and ocular degeneration. These are all things that affect people on Earth, maybe to a much lesser extent. But okay, what we learn in the extreme treatments and countermeasures there, we've been able to apply in the medical community on Earth for a host of conditions as well.
Now, the texts are interesting because, you know, what a lot of people are texting to ask is, okay, for example, someone texts from Ballantyr to say, the moon belongs to everyone. Now even that's being privatized. Is there any hope for ordinary mankind? Who will protect the common interest in space exploration? I don't trust the capitalists. Jim in Cork. Please ask Douglas, who will own the moon? Flag planting started with the first landing on the moon. Could Brendan ask the space guest, Douglas, who will govern the moon? 15 countries involved. What about Russians, China at all? So people are concerned about A, the politics, and B, the money situation here.
Great questions and very valid concerns. So we're really pleased to point out the fact that in what we've done, I mentioned the International Space Station because it's a great model for how we'll work as a community in space. And what we've seen in my lifetime is space move from a very competitive kind of bipolar enterprise to now a very collaborative international enterprise. And that's the way we see it moving forward. So we have a great model on International Space Station where we have policies and rules about how to work together in space. And they've been very, very successful,
okay,
by the way.
Are China and the U.S. working together on space at all?
Today, China is not a part of that partnership. I'm hopeful that in the future we'll have conditions that allow other countries to join that consortium of countries that are, as I said, 15 partners in International Space Station. Every day we see new countries entering the space enterprise.
So actually, in an era of, I'm not going to talk politics with you, but in an era here on Earth of possibly America first and a lot of tension internationally and everything, and give space was, I guess, at the vanguard of the first Cold War, really, and it was acted out in many ways through the space race. Actually, space could start providing a model for international cooperation.
Absolutely. And if you this is one for which we have an existence proof. So if you think about the first efforts to kind of temper the Cold War, you can think of the Apollo-Soyuz missions where we jointly worked with our former Soviet colleagues in doing that. That was one of the first sort of diplomatic olive branches, if you will, to open that collaboration between science, which is kind of that purview of everybody in the planet, that knows no boundaries, right? So it's a really great opportunity for us to, again, extend that model to continue to use it as a way to build collaborations. And the goal is to use that same approach when we get to the moon, to have it be an international enterprise. And it's important that we at NASA see that as the model going forward, and I think it'll be a very successful approach.
Now, the question that I've been told I have to absolutely ask you is there life on other planets?
Yeah.
So, are you going to give me an equivocal answer?
You an equivocal answer. So the this is a question, obviously, that's, mankind's been wrestling with since the beginning of time. The amazing thing is that with the technology we have today, we're able now for the first time. When I left DC on Monday, we were able to confirm, I think, over 4,000 Earth-like exoplanets, planets around other stars. If I'd been here just a few years ago, we would be talking about speculation that there are planets like, you know, Earth-like conditions elsewhere. Okay. We now know for a fact that there are thousands, and we're finding thousands every year. So the conditions that we look for life, the presence of water, the right temperature and environmental conditions to promote life, are now known to be fairly common in the universe. That's a huge step forward. We are now... We've seen for the first time signs of, you know, markers for organic materials on other planets with our rovers on Mars, with what we've seen around the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. We've seen conditions even in, icy moons with water under the surface where we see the potential for life conditions. And we have a series of missions that are going to launch in the next couple of years that are specifically targeted to drill into the soil, look for organic materials, to look for that confirmation, as well as a series of telescopes that are looking at the atmospheres and the condition of the planets.
Gut feeling, Douglas. Come on, put yourself on the line. What's your own feeling about it?
The probability, in my own time in this business, just a couple of decades here, I have seen us go from, as I said, wild speculation to everything that we expect to see on the path to that discovery has proven to be true. So I expect that in a few decades, we will get conclusive proof.
Wow. That's going to blow everyone's mind, isn't it?
It is. You know, this is something that I can't overstate, that we live at a time where many of these very, very profound questions about, you know, how's the universe work? Are we alone in the
universe?
We are prepared to answer.
We are the center of the universe now, is how we pretty much regard it.
Right.
And space is out there and it revolves around us.
Exactly. Some of these things that we're going to discover in the next decade will absolutely change our understanding of what it means to be human and our place in the universe. And I don't think you can overstate how profound that is to, you know, not just to science and technology, but to philosophy and culture and every aspect of life.
Yeah, wow. So do you watch space films or do they drive
you
nuts?
I do. No, I do. I'm quite a buff. Yeah. And there's been a few recently that have been quite good, I think, and really helped to ignite.
Okay, which ones do you reckon were on the ball?
So I probably don't want to endorse anything, but you know, actually NASA collaborated with the author of The Martian and collaborated in making that film, and that's one that I think really helps to illustrate the challenge of living in such an austere environment while making it fun to watch, right?
Yeah, and do you think that was? I mean, obviously there was license taken with how he managed to build this little settlement for himself out of bits and pieces and whatever, but largely was it scientifically?
The cool thing is that the author Andy worked with us throughout developing that script and developing the book itself and then the movie, and he consulted with NASA scientists, so that much of the basis for a lot of those that you see him doing these improvising various things are scientifically accurate.
Okay, I think what a lot of Irish people kind of connected with about The Martian was the attempt to grow potatoes.
Of course, right.
But the crop failed.
Right.
But that is all technically possible.
It is technically possible. Okay. And it's a really important point to make that, because it's so expensive and difficult to get things off the Earth, our future missions will rely on us developing resources where we are kind of living off the land. And that's an example of where we can. On Mars, for example, you've got sunlight, you've got water, you've got soil. You can grow things. And that includes growing, the food that you'll need to survive over a long term.
Is your life not going to be incomplete if you don't get to space? Have you tried?
I have to tell you, I have tried. I have applied. It's a very difficult process. I'll give you an example. Last year, we needed a new class of astronauts a couple of years ago for 12 new astronauts. So we put out a call. We got 18,000 qualified applicants. And by qualified, I mean some of these people have, incredible test pilot experience, as well as being an MD, medical doctor. So we're talking about a very qualified and very exclusive group. Would my life be complete? Absolutely, because I've had the amazing opportunity to be part of that team that's part of this enterprise. And I think all of us, there's about 17,000 civil servants, about 50,000 contractors that support NASA, as well as all our international collaborators. And if you think about it, of all the generations that lived on this planet, of the 7-8 billion people on this planet, we have the opportunity to be a part of this. What I said, we were on the verge of these incredible discoveries that were science fiction just a few decades ago.
That alone is a very practical question, Douglas, before you go, from Cormac. Ask Douglas, please, who polices space? If a crime occurs on the moon or in the International Space Station, who investigates?
Ah, that's a great question. So, you know, we basically model the rules on the International Space Station sort of off of maritime law. So in each section of this, you know, there's a Russian segment, there's a U.S. segment, there's a European segment and so on, Japanese experiment module. And each country's sort of responsible for what happens in their part of it. But we generally observe international law, and those are pretty well understood. And again, it is, I can't stress how collaborative that environment is.
Okay, so there, probably not a high crime rate. Anyway,
not a high crime rate, yeah.
Okay, one more. So this is again on the practicalities. When something precious or vital is discovered, who's going to own, claim that, or will everybody be nice and share?
Yeah, so the goal is, as I said, to extend the model we have now for this to be an international enterprise. I think it would be naive to think there won't be commercial motives in space eventually, because things will be developed that are precious. One of the most exciting areas is when we talk about developing space, it's not just about the technology people, it's about, you know, an emerging field of space law, about property rights, about all the things that we need to, you know, to conduct business in space. And those rules are being developed as we speak. So I'm
okay,
anxious
so
to
we,
see how
we
that'll
need
come
to get up there fast and stake our claim. Get a bit of land on Mars. Okay, Douglas Terrier, Chief Technologist with NASA, thank you very much, and we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.